About the same time, July, 1931, another scientist was embarrassed. The Russian physiologist, Pavlov, had announced that he had taught white mice to respond to a bell, at mealtime. But now see here. Just how disdainful should persons who put in their time ringing dinner bells for mice be of others who collect accounts of meandering pans of soft soap? It was Pavlov's statement, or announcement, that he had taught white mice to respond to a bell, at mealtime, and that a second generation of white mice had been keener in so responding. This improvement was supposed to represent cumulative hereditary influences. But Sir Arthur Thompson, of Aberdeen, Scotland, made an announcement. And now see here, again. I should like to hear Sir Arthur's opinion upon the dignity of such subjects as the vanishing man, and stones that were pegged at a farmer's knees. He, too, had been ringing dinner bells for animals. Thompson's announcement was that he had noted no improved teachableness in a second generation of white mice. Whereupon Pavlov withdrew his announcement, saying that he must have been deceived by his assistant. This is becoming a stock retreat. Before he shot himself, in August, 1925, Professor Kammerer, accused of having faked, with India ink, what he called acquired characters on the feet of toads, explained that he had been betrayed by an assistant. I conceive that, though Pavlov retreated before a higher authority, his white mice may have been keener in a second generation, though nobody else's white mice would have been of any improved discernment in a 15th generation, and that, though biologically, nuptial pads could not possibly appear upon the feet of Professor Kammerer's toads. Pictures on hailstones, a face on a cathedral wall, and an insect takes on the appearance of a leaf. That it may be that a man did not altogether deceive himself and others, but that faint markings did appear upon the feet of toads, as responses to his theory, but in all the uncertainty and the evanescence of the incipient that, convinced that he was right, Professor Kammerer may have supplemented faint markings with India ink, just to tide over, at a time of inquiry then exposure suicide. The story of cancer cure announcements is a record of abounding successes in the treatment of cancerous dogs, cats, chickens, rats, mice, and guinea pigs, followed by appeals to the public for funds for the study of the unknown causes, and the still undiscovered cure for cancer. Look over the records of cancerous growths that, according to triumphant announcements, have been absorbed, or stopped, in mice and guinea pigs, and try to think that all were only deliberate deceptions. My good bad opinion of human nature won't stand it. But, if some of these experiments were the successes they were said to be, and if the treatments are now repudiated or forgotten, these successes were realized imaginings. I know of nothing in science that has the look of better establishment than that there have been some cures of cancer, under radium treatment. But, in the year 1930, the British Radium Commission issued a warning that the use of radium had not been established as a cancer cure. The look to me is that, in all the earnestness and charlatanry, devotion to ideals, and fakery, and insincerity, exploitations and dupe rise of this cult, some cures, as if by the use of radium, have occurred, but that applications of soft soap, if subject to an equal intensity of thought, would have done just as well. Which brings us to the appalling unnecessity of vivisection, if experiments upon the animals of a toy Noah's Ark, to cure them of their splinters, would be just as enlightening, if anything can be construed into meaning anything that anybody wants it to mean in an existence in which there is not meaning, but meaning meaninglessness. And not wanting to write 300 or 400 pages upon this subject, I shall not go much into records of professorial rascals, or faithful and devoted scientists, who have exploited, or have tried to minister unto, the desire of old codgers to caper. I take from the New York Evening Post, April 12, 1928, an account of discoveries of major importance to the science of rejuvenation, as announced, in Berlin, by Professor Stinich, to the annual Congress of German Surgeons. Professor Stinich's announcement was that he had discovered the secret of rejuvenation in uses of the pituitary gland. If any reader isn't quite sure where the pituitary is, I remind him that it is connected with the fundibulum. It is in a part of the body that is most profoundly engaged in sex relations. It is in the brain. Dr. Stinich announced that, with 12 injections of pituitary serum, in senile rats, he had restored their failing appetites, induced a new growth of hair, rejuvenated all bodily functions, and had generally transformed ailing, or half-dead, creatures into youthful animals. There is witchcraft in science. If bald old rats have turned young and hairy, if dogs, fed on coal products, have astonishingly fattened, if tens of thousands of mice and guinea pigs have magically gone fat, or gone thin, in the presence of experimenters. If, in not all these cases has the treacherous, or perhaps kind-hearted, assistant slipped, say, a brisk and hairy young rat into the place of a decrepit old codger, or has not, in secret rascality, or benevolence, meatily supplemented the fare of dogs supposed to be thriving upon coal products. If not in all these cases have eminent trappers lied snares for dollars. My pseudo-conclusion, or acceptance, which is as far as I can go, in the fiction that we're living, is that some of these announcements have been pretty nearly faithful reports of occurrences, and that, by witchcraft, or in response to intense desires of experimenters, senile rats have lost the compensations of old age, and have suffered again the tormenting restlessness of youth, all this by witchcraft, and not by injections that in themselves could have no more of a rejuvenating effect upon either rats or humans than upon mummies. But, if Professor Stinich, by witchcraft, or by the effects of belief, did grow hair upon the bald skin of a rat, to say nothing of the more frolicsome effects of his practices, how comes it that he was not equally successful with the human subjects of his sorcery? Today the Stinich treatment stands discredited. Especially destructive have been Dr. Alexis Carrel's attacks upon it. It may be that the professor's own greed defeated him. It may be that he failed because he dissipated his sorcery among many customers. 25. If I can bridge a gap. Then that, in a moment of religious excitation, an inhabitant of Remiremont, focusing upon a point in the sky, transferred a pictorial representation from his mind to hailstones. The turning, off Coventry Street, streets in Japan, Kiel, Berlin, New York City, other places, and that wounds, as imagined by haters of people, have appeared upon the bodies of people. Or the story of the sailor aboard the steamship Brixey, in December, 1931, and that it was during a storm, and that in the mind of somebody else aboard this vessel a hate pictured this man, as struck by lightning, and that upon his head appeared a wound, as pictured. The gap, or the supposed gap, is the difference, or the supposed, absolute difference, between the imagined and the physical. Or, for instance, the disappearance of Ambrose Small, of Toronto, and it was just about what his secretary, who had embezzled from him, probably wished for, probably unaware that an inventory would betray him. A picturization, in the secretary's mind, of his employer, shooting away to Patagonia, to Franz Josef Land, or to the moon, so far away that he could never get back, but could the imagined realize? Or why didn't I keep track, in the newspapers of December, 1919, for mention of the body of a man, washed up on a beach of Java, scarcely decipherable papers in the pockets indicating that the man was a Canadian? Are the so-called asteroids bodies of people who have been witched away into outer space? Rose Smith, that when she was released from prison, her visualizations crept up behind her former employer, and killed him? According to some viewpoints, I might as well try to think of a villain, in a moving picture, suddenly jumping from the screen, and attacking people in the audience. I haven't tried that, yet. Case of Emma Piggott and the fires in the home of her employers were just about what the girl, alarmed by the greediness of her thefts, may have wished for. Also, there are data that may mean that, because of experiences unknown to anybody else, this girl knew that, from a distance, she could start fires. There is an appearance of affinity between the Piggott case and the fires in the house in Bedford. There was a sulfur fire that was ordinary. It was followed by a series of fires that were, at least according to impressions in Bedford, extraordinary. In no terms of physics, nor of chemistry, was an explanation possible, yet investigators felt that a relationship of some kind did exist. The relationship may have existed in the mind of Anne Fenimore. After the sulfur fire had been put out, she may have started fearing fires, especially in the absence of the only male member of the household. Her fear may have realized. Story of the Caldwell girl here, too. Fires in a house seem to have related to a girl's mental state, or that the fires were related to her desire to move to another house. Having the not uncommon experience of learning how persuasive are police captains, she listened to advice, and confessed to effects, in terms of ordinary incendiarism, though, according to reports by firemen and policemen, some of the fires could not have been produced by flipping lighted matches. In the case of Jenny Bramwell, there is no knowing what were the feelings of this girl, who had been adopted, probably to do hard farm work. If she, too, had nascently the fire-inducing power, which manifested under the influence of desire, or emotion, I think of her, in the midst of drudgery, wishing destruction upon the property of her exploiters, and fires following. At any rate, the story of the little Barnes girl, which quite equals anything from the annals of demonology, is very suggestive, or the smolder of hate, in the mind of a child, for an exploiter and flames leaped upon a woman.